Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today we have a really interesting guest who is going to help me focus on an aspect of this podcast that often gets a little bit overlooked, kind of assumed, the ways that we can do farming that reduce our inputs as low as possible, sometimes even down to zero. That's our ideal. But Nathaniel also does some crop breeding work and has some thoughts on social networking. We've got all the usual things and more to talk about. So I'll throw over to Nathaniel. Tell me a bit about your background and your path in life that led you into crop breeding, low input agriculture, all the good things that we talk about.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here. And I'd like to recognize that this place, Indigenous peoples of this land, the Osage, the Kickapoo, and the Quapaw, who originally stewarded this land and managed this area and gave us a reasonable framework on the best practices here. So I'd like to recognize that to all my relations, to all my friends at the Ozark Agrarian News, to all my friends at the Ozark Area Community Congress, a todos mis amigos del sur, to all my friends in Africa, to all my friends in Asia, to all my friends in Micronesia, Polynesia, the Hawaiian Islands, New Zealand, Australia, to all my relations. So yes, so originally I became interested in nature living on the West Coast. I was an avid surfer and I had some really spectacular experiences in nature, in the ocean, you know, having, you know, encounters with whales, you know, in the wild, and many other sea life, marine life. And I wanted to become a marine biologist or an oceanographer. So I went to school and studied, you know, my general education and got into a botany class with Mitchell Beauchamp. And he showed me vernal pools and the smallest flora known to man that was named the Wolfia species that was named after him. And I became enraptured with botany and plant life and shifted my focus onto the land. So I decided I wanted to study agriculture. And so I went to a university in California, California Polytechnic, San Luis Obispo. They had a very good agriculture classes there. So I ended up going and studying for 4 years, did not touch on anything of substance until Jim Phillips, Regenerative Ag, you know, a path, one of the giants, you know, and he's teaching us yeoman's work. So we didn't learn anything of substance essentially until the fourth year. And so I'm ready to go out and hit the job market, and I'm getting interviews, and every single interview is pretty much the same. It's a petrochemical seed company, or, you know, it's working in the Central Valley under a reductionist viewpoint framework, and, you know, giving advice to farmers. And what do I have to offer coming out of school? Right. All I know is what I've been told. Right. So, yeah. So I was going to finish school and get the job. And I had like one more administrative class, and it was, you know, an elective or something. And it was just the whole thing. I saw the whole thing for the sham that it was. And I just left it all, and I went and got a proper education. I went and lived in a treehouse in Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
and right? And that's where I learned about the Finca Ipe tree on Finca Ipe Ranchero, where we had 50 acres of Pau de Arco trees growing medicinal bark. And tropical agriculture and ideas of permaculture, and really just the ideas meeting up with hands-on experiential living in the biosphere, living in the most dense rainforest on the planet, and this was in the early 90s. And I met Mountain Mike, who left California in 1982 and bought 80 acres for 3,000 colones. And it was all degraded pasture land. And he had regenerated that land, and it was an oasis. And I had met Mike. I traveled into the mountains. I hiked for a couple of days to find this guy. And it blew my mind, the possibilities. Well, one, that you can take this this piece of land that was basically just, you know, horrendously eroded and leached, and within 10 years already have your climax tree species, you know, reaching past the pioneer species. So yeah, so bringing forward that hands-on education and the holistic viewpoint and becoming a person of the land, being able to read the land and understand the rhythm of the land, and not so much these ideas that we need to look at the parts. And so that's what brought me into alignment with natural farming. So coming from the West, you know, it's hard for us to totally grasp, you know, some of these concepts and traditions that Master Cho brings. And we interpret them in our lens. And I do not believe that some of these interpretations are the spirit of natural farming, because, you know, natural farming is about balance, dynamic equilibriums. And we always want to go to the place of where is the pesticide? How do I make the pesticide so that I can kill those things that are causing me problems?
Do you think there's a fundamental issue with, how to put this, with mass communication? So like our industrial education system is designed to be like a, you know, a production line. It is limited to concepts that can be, you know, put on a board or printed out on a in a textbook and examined in an exam at the end of the, you know, module. And do you suspect that there's a lot going on in like syntropic and Korean natural farming that doesn't just boil down to a few paragraphs that you can memorize?
Yeah, so here's the thing. That summary that I wrote in my essay is about as to the extent that I want to try to relate these concepts to people with words. Mm. You know, it's all about hands-on and workshops and master to student transmission, you know, not so much YouTube videos, although they're useful, but you know, we're missing the point that nature is the teacher.
Mm.
And it's up to us to make keen observations and correct intuitive insights, correct insights. So to the extent that we're able to do that and keen and sharpen those skills, is to the extent that we're competent in being able to be land stewards and people of the land.
Mm. It's like the difference between knowing a list of symptoms for somebody having malaria to actually being in the room and smelling them and touching them. Like there's all these other channels of communication that formalized learning doesn't really have access to. The direct experience is ultimately the real teacher in these complex dynamic systems.
Exactly. And so with Korean natural farming, we're going to our ancestors. And then in the respect that, you know, these microbes are, you know, populations are reproducing every 30 minutes, then they're adapting so quickly.
Can you give us a good overview of Korean natural farming? That might be a good place to start. We'll flip the order a bit and we'll talk about low input methods of farming first. So sure. A lot of our readers, a lot of our audience have probably never encountered Korean natural farming before. So can you give us a kind of an idea about what it is?
Sure. Yes. So Master Cho was involved with the Green Revolution and saw the negative consequences of industrial and mechanization, pesticides, all of these issues. And so he studied the microbiology of the soil and came up with specific strategies to capture and colonize the natural microbes that are in healthy forest soils. And so we're basically going and finding the most ancient microbes, which would be under your deciduous trees, you know, in the temperate zones here, in bamboo forests and tropics, where, you know, we're looking for mycorrhizal fungi, and we're leaving basically food for them to colonize. We're collecting that, so it's a very low impact. We're not rutting around, and we're not disturbing, you know, the natural areas. So we're able to harvest these and colonize them, and then utilize them for farm inputs by making teas and making basically soil inputs and harmonizing these soil inputs with our farm soils, our garden soils. So it's process of fermentation, of using fermentation in order to alchemize these substances and utilize the microbes that are naturally present in our biome, in our air. So we're emphasizing on lactic acid bacteria, wild strains of yeast, diversity. We want maximum diversity and we want maximum localization. And then we also want to increase our range a few kilometers outside of our garden space and find the most fertile areas outside of our farm or watershed, maybe in a natural forest, a natural park, somewhere like that, and do some collections there, do some collections under different types of trees, get a diverse range of microbes. And then we put these colonized collections into hyperstasis by, you know, inoculating them with sugar. So we're basically able to take and create shelf stable products that are good for years on good collections. Now, these collections require using our senses, like you're alluding to. You know, if I wrote a book and I explained to you what you're looking for in this collection box, you're probably not going to get it right.
So let me see if I get this right. So the industrial model of fertility is that plants absorb soluble nutrients. So you can just make those in a factory, pour them on the plant, it absorbs the nutrients and you get more growth. And that works to some degree, particularly if you breed crops to respond to those chemical fertilizers. That's pretty much what the Green Revolution was. But if you look at naturally growing plants, they access nutrients from the soil via microbes. So there's a symbiotic relationship where the plant provides the microbes, usually with sugars that they produce in abundance from their photosynthesis. And in return, the microbes, well, a whole range of different microbes will isolate nutrients from the soil and then pass them on to the plant. And that's the real foundation of fertility and vitality in ecosystems. So Korean natural farming is trying to restore those missing microbial communities by locating them in relatively undisturbed parts of the ecosystem and then bringing them into cultivated spaces. Is that the broad idea?
Yeah, that's the linchpin of the system, is utilizing indigenous microorganisms. Then we're also able to make farm inputs utilizing the natural plants that are growing over the seasons. We can harvest those plants and ferment them and apply those in diluted concentrations on foliar with foliar applications. So all of the inputs that we need for, you know, having full cycle healthy crops are here on our properties. And it's just up to us to be able to see and utilize these plants. So what I'm looking for in the early season is I'm looking for fast nitrogen grasses, C4 grasses. I could cut those. I could ferment those. And 7 days later, I've got a fertilizer that's perfectly suited for the plant, uptakes readily, foliar applications. It's scalable. You can put it in your spray rig, spray your orchard down. And so what we're really learning is how to be in rhythm with nature, knowing what to apply at what stage of growth. So it's focusing on the life cycles of our plants and being so familiar with these plants that we can sort of preempt them into the next growth stage, because we're in tune with the cues, the subtle pheromones and different cues that the plants are putting off that tells us they're ready to go into flowering or they're ready to go into their next life cycle stage. So we're applying very low input. I mean, these concentrations are so diluted that it's nearly homeopathic levels. So it's not like we're concentrated on our NPKs.
And I get the impression that more, particularly with nitrogen, more recent research is finding that pretty much all plants have microbes in symbiosis that do nitrogen fixation for them when they need it in a healthy system. That it's rare that nitrogen is a limiting input in a functional, complete ecosystem of plants and microbes working together.
Exactly. So, you know, natural farming emphasizes simplicity, you know, and so what I really like about the inputs that we make is that we're able to harvest them from our farms. We can grow them typically. They're very easy to grow. And we make tinctures that are able to give to us as practitioners, to our livestock, and also for the plants. So the same plant foods, like we're making fertilizers, we're consuming them as well. So, you know, we're making fish amino acids, we're making fermented plant juices, we're making herbal nutrient solutions that we're applying to our seedlings and inoculating our seeds, pre-treating our seeds. And so all of these uses are also shared with our livestock. So, you know, in the pursuit of knowledge, every day something is gained. In natural farming, every day something is taken away, because we're looking for that simplicity, because you gain so much in a minimalist system.
I'm curious too. So from the original foundation by Master Cho in Korea, how has Korean natural farming evolved and is continuing to evolve? Like, do practitioners regularly experiment? Like, is it a kind of open-ended practice where everybody has to like tinker in their own circumstances?
Yeah, basically it's small plots. There's like 1 hectare plots, and so it really lends itself well to, like, you know, making small batches and applying with hand sprayers. But it also lends itself well to scaling up and, you know, applying on 100 to 1,000 hectare commercial projects. And so that's why I'm excited about it, because, you know, so some of the practices in natural farming don't speak to underlying context of our sites, the hydrology, you know, some of the deeper aspects that we need to focus on. And there's also some aspects to the other system that I'm very interested in, the centropic agroforestry.
Yeah, we'll move on to that next. Definitely move on to the next one thing.
We could spend this whole time just talking about, you know, K&F.
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. How do K&F practitioners address, what's the word, criticisms or questions about whether it is actually effective? Like, do you experience, like, if you run out of a spray and you only get to spray half of a bed, do you see a big difference in performance? Like, what are the mechanisms for, like, truth testing that are in the culture? Because it's very easy for humans to, like, you know, start believing in something, but it's nice to be able to test it periodically.
Yeah. So as far as, like, scientific trials and information on that, I have not even worried to go down the reductionist pathway since I walked away from that world. So I know from experience, and that is all that matters in my world. right? Because I'm not trying to prove it to anybody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I'm feeding myself. And so I can't offer anything there for you. Anyways, right
Yeah,
now, I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure I could find something, but I don't want to look at that. I mean, I don't want to. I know from the glow of the plants,
Yeah.
from the taste of the fruit, from the overall thriving, the rush, and, you know, I also know from the smell of the microflora too. So
yeah.
So in the microbiology, it also speaks to me, right, into that intuition. And so
it's a little bit tricky.
Whether or not I can prove it to other people that this is viable, I'm part of the philosophy is, you know, so I'm not trying to convince anybody of anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because I can't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's futile. And I think that when people try to control outcomes is where we run down the reductionist road and the multipolar traps.
It's tricky
and
too.
Dilemmas and all that.
It's tricky too with something like KNF, which is driven by microbes. It's not like a chemical fertilizer where you can put the chemicals on one bed and not the other bed and see that direct impact. The microbes,
right.
once they're in that area, they're going to spread. They're going to change the space around them. It's a little bit like taking a human being and cutting them down the middle, and I'll give this side aspirin and that side no aspirin. Which one is going to do better? You can't disconnect the two parts of the system without, you know, damaging it and destroying it.
Right. So when I read your book and the vitreous womb brings, so to my mind, when we're talking about, I went into the womb of the earth. I went into a Lakota sweat lodge ritual.
Mm.
And when I went into the womb of the earth, I saw things, right? And I saw my ancestors. And I saw my relation to the tree and the frog. And that's why when I say to all my relations, I mean to all my relations, right?
Mm.
So when I came out of that womb, it was a death experience. You know, you go into the womb and die.
Mm.
And it's uncomfortable. It's, you lose, you shed so many toxins and so many unclean thoughts and unhealthy modalities when you go through a ritual where you have to rely on the community.
Mm.
And you lose that idea that, like, I've got to protect myself from this. I'm dying in here. I need to get out.
Mm.
Because, you know, those thoughts are running through your mind when you're in that ritual.
Mm.
And so we sing songs to our ancestors and we go through the ritual to put our intentions forth. And so our intention was for transformation to occur.
Mm.
You know, in the greater social realm. And so when I came out of the womb, what I saw was I saw hope for my nieces and nephews of Generation Z who, you know, feel hopeless and are rejecting the superficiality of the screens, right?
Mm.
And the consumptive lifestyle and are yearning for meaningful work with their hands.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, what is more meaningful than working for the benefit of the seventh generation? I mean, I can't think of anything more. I'm completely taken over. She has me. I am of the land. I can't.
Yeah.
She's got me.
Yeah.
and my life is dedicated. Every ounce of my energy goes into restoration.
Yeah.
Because the land's sick, you know, and I see it. She, you know, a lot of work to be done.
Well, on that front, tell us about syntropic agriculture, because this is another relatively new approach to land management, to production management in the West. Can you tell us a bit of an overview about what it is? What are the core ideas behind syntropic agriculture?
Right. It's like jargon, right? The core of it, there's this guy who had a vision, who the earth grabbed him and told him what to do. And he went and did it, right? And everybody looks at it and says, wow, that works. That's cool. What is that? Mm. Right? But it's really, it's indigenous practices that for the most part, and it's not necessarily anything new or novel in that sense that, you know, other people can follow a model. See, now that's where I think that we're all going to screw things up when we start to all follow the models.
Yeah.
Because then we'll end up in the same place that we're at now. Eventually, right? Because we're not living with the land and letting the land tell us what to do, right? So basically what we're doing is we're mimicking nature, and we're understanding that there's life all the way from birth through senescence.
Yeah.
And so we as caretakers and stewards, we can bring forward and maximize succession and rapidly bring forth the health of the soil through integration of perennials and annuals together in a hugely dynamic system.
Mm.
And I would say for practitioners, it's the most advanced methodology that you can try to achieve. It's very complex. Very complex. Now, if you look at it, I'm going to explain you the matrix of how we look at strata and emergence and, you know, what I'm going to plant, you know, look, you can lose yourself in the weeds in a heartbeat with this and get down into that reductionist mindset of, okay, I need my list of my placenta one, placenta two, you know, We have to show by bringing people into the system, right? Because it's all context. And because if I just tell you, look, this is what you do, right? We're all just going to screw it up because, you know, Ernst Grosch was in Brazil.
Yeah.
I'm in the Ozarks.
Yeah.
And I'm working with hickories, oaks, cherries, you know, maples, beech, birch, you know, completely different species.
Yeah.
Right?
Can I have a go at can I have a go at summarizing what my impression is of syntropic agriculture?
Sure, yeah.
So, and in some ways it's related to Korean natural farming, but it's based on bringing together diverse families of plants where their root exudates support different communities of microbes, and then managing the cycles of growth and cutting back of those plants to stimulate positive interactions between all of the living things in that system.
Yes.
That's that's roughly it.
Unconditional love, right.
Well, but it's also like often severely cutting back plants at just the right timing to benefit not just them, but everything in the community.
Right. So we're looking at a watershed. We're looking at a broader context, as broad of context as we can look at.
Mm.
And we're trying to find areas that need or speak to us. This is where the land is telling us and dreaming of a forest, right? Mm. So it's up to us to dream of community. So when I come into this, I'm looking at the senescence of a particular parcel, and I'm looking at these dead trees and these, you know, areas that need to be rejuvenated. So I'm going to come in and disturb this whole area, which is a natural process of nature, and it's needed to rejuvenate. So when I come in behind that disturbance, I'm coming in with a shot of, you know, in my world, it's Korean natural farming, IMO, and I'm applying that to my placentas, you know, where I've got my C4 grasses building the biomass that I'm going to, you know, use for our nutrient cycling in the agroforestry system, right? So I'm looking at a 30-year clearing. So the plants that I'm putting in my consortium are going to have annuals through perennials of 30 years in management, right? So it's a real broad horizon, time horizon, right? And it's also a really broad aperture of like, of what we're considering in the ecology, right? Because we're going in all the way down from microbial life, the mineral life, the hydrology there, right? The solar aspects, like the land, right? How the land speaks to us. We have to use all of this, right? So it's just this creative palette. And when we're people of the land, we start to be able to use the different colors and start painting and being creative and watch the results, right? And it all is about diversity. So we're going to plant so densely that we're talking like 40 plants per square meter. And we're going to use nature stacking the deck because she loves a big selection, right? So we're going to take, we're going to find those ones that are just glowing, right? The ones that are just saying, we're going to grow here.
Yeah.
And we'll select those and get rid of the rest, right? And so our canopies are dense in time and also dense in space. So it's a full emergence in time and space and participation. It's full immersion in nature. It's unbelievable.
It's interesting how complementary different emerging management systems are. So Korean natural farming seems to be the very hands-on manage the microbes by hand in sprays and fermentations. The Syntropic seems to be managing the microbes through planting the density and diversity of plants and then manually cutting them at times. And there's another strand in the managed intensive rotational grazing community who are learning to time those impacts and stimulate microbes and plants through animals, through livestock. And all of those feel like they're complementary parts of a toolkit for humans to interact with landscapes that doesn't rely on all of the industrial tools and inputs that we've become so dependent upon in the last century or two.
Right. So they're totally dovetailing, and we're using Korean natural farming to kickstart our demonstration plots. And also we're using that in our silvopastures, pastures, right? So in, you know, agroforestry, we're basically doing all of the types of agroforestry, silvopasture, horticulture, syntropic. So syntropic in the sense that it's a physical science meaning of syntropy versus entropy. So, you know, basically any of these systems are syntropic if we're storing energy and heat. And that's permaculture, right? So it's like just jargon to me now. I just see the land and it tells me what to do. And I have to get people next to me and on shoulder to shoulder. And we do this. We come and restore these landscapes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where it's at. And that's why I'm so excited, because, you know, we're looking at these programs, we're incorporating, you know, workshops and bringing in opportunities for students. I've been contacting University of Missouri, Missouri State, in order to work closer with them, because they have the only agroforestry department in the country.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there's only one.
So how does this all tie into breeding? Because that's the other really interesting aspect of this, because you can breed crops and livestock for these kinds of systems.
Exactly. Yeah. So I've been, you know, working with sorghum and, you know, using the Milo, old world Milo European sorghum I got from University of Florida. So I'm interested in a non-tannin grain. I don't want to have to leach them. And, you know, they're kind of a short phenotype, and they fit in quite unique niches around here where, you know, some of the taller field corns, you know, I would struggle to sort of try to figure out what I'm going to do with these guys sometimes. So I really like the sorghum, and I'm feeding them to my chickens. And so part of this, you know, a Korean natural farming is incorporating your livestock, and specifically chickens. We like the fowl. We like, you know, ducks in these systems. Goats are great. you know, I don't have to worry about making a bunch of farm inputs when the biology is working, right? I'm converting solar energy into high quality meat, right? When I'm grazing. So, you know, every single box is ticked when we're incorporating Korean natural farming. We don't rely on the feed stores. We're making all of our inputs here on the farm, right? And in compost teas, the plants, amazing. You just, you know, it's all anecdotal hand waving. I don't care.
have you done much work on breeding the sorghum? Like, have you tried different genetics in the start?
I haven't done any cross. I'm just selectively breeding for, you know, my traits.
Yeah.
The traits I'm looking for. So, no, I mean, where I'm going with my breeding work is I'm taking my kayak and floating down the river, and I'm looking for rare tree species to collect seed from so that I can propagate that out here. And so I'm interested in, you know, rootstock, and also, you know, just having enough, you know, enough plant material to plant out, you know, the acre. So if I was to rely on sourcing this stuff from some other source, I mean, I'm exporting, I'm delegating my responsibility to bring in the material. So when I'm collecting seed, I know exactly what that tree looked like.
Yeah.
And I'm picking out the best one.
Well,
it's
the ultimate form of low input mass selection. If you have wild populations of useful species around you. So it's a really, if you've got that resource, if you've got that opportunity, selecting out genetic material of the best trees in your region is such a powerful technique.
Right. Now, as it turns out, like, you know, that's basically what the Amazon rainforest is like, you know, and the you know, basically all the Northeast United States, these are all manicured landscapes, you know, stewarded by the original people, the indigenous people.
Yeah, you're definitely not starting with unimproved material. That it's been under active selection for who knows how many thousands of years before we came along.
Right, and the precarious nature of our foods, these lines are very weak, right? And it's staggering how unstable our food supply really is, you know. And you know, people who aren't familiar with the challenges in agronomy of trying to feed the world, you know, we're peak oil, we're also peak yields.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a new paradigm, right? And so...
Do you want to spend a bit of time talking about your experiences with the challenges of like adapting and scaling a staple crop to a meaningful proportion of a human diet? Because I think... particularly this time in history, there's a lot of emphasis on fruits and vegetables and, you know, the fun, you know, nice things to eat. And the staple crops kind of get ignored because we live in a world saturated with cheap industrial staples. So it's very easy to take them for granted. And it's only when you actually put the effort into trying to grow them for yourself that you realize that it's not straightforward. And achieving reliable success on a meaningful scale, there's some hurdles to overcome. So can you talk a bit more around that?
Sure. You know, it's what I'm looking for is I want to have more than just one staple, right? And I want to have staples that are storable and staples that can deal with the severe conditions that we have with the ongoing severity of climate change. So, you know, sorghum fits that for me. It's a C4 crop, so as a grass, and able to take our intense summers and slow down when the water isn't present. So when we have lots of water, it's able to onboard that. So it's been a winter here. But as far as like the challenge of being able to actually grow, like, how do you grow enough food to feed yourself, right? So if it was a grain like wheat, I would say, you know, your 250 square meter bed minimum, I would do 500. And what I did in sorghum here was just test plots. So, you know, I had about a quarter pound of seed that I was working with. So I planted all that out and had a few of my, two of my terrace gardens planted. It's about, you know, 1,000 square feet. Yeah. So it wasn't all that many plants, but it was quite a prolific yielder. So I've got several 5-gallon buckets full of sorghum seed that I make popcorn with and grind it to make bread. It doesn't have gluten, so it's different. So you gotta cook like flatbreads and stuff.
Was that it's in itself an adaptation process to like change your culinary tastes on?
Oh,
like
for
it,
sure.
It's all very well to like try something once and go, oh, isn't that interesting? But eating it every day as like a major part of your diet, changing that routine partway through your life can be way more challenging than people realize. I think even people who like go and, you know, work in Japan for a few years find that, oh, suddenly having like 80% of their diet as being rice is a struggle for them because it's not what they're used to.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because they're, you know, the industrial food supply, the food industry, you know, just spikes the food with sugar. It's completely contaminated, right? And so when you get off of that, you have this insane desire for sweets, right? So like that's the biggest hurdle. I just eat honey, local honey.
Yeah.
And molasses, right? So that's another byproduct of the sorghum.
How did you end up settling on sorghum as one of your more useful crops? Did you try other species and have different performance with them?
Right. So I was doing some field corn. I was trying to get some land-raised dent corn. And here it's too wet in the summers. It rotted before it dried. So it wasn't a great performer for me. And plus the added labor involved in processing dent corn to get it shucked and shelled and treated with lye in order to make it digestible. It was just too many steps. And I didn't want to feed it to my livestock because feeding them cracked grains is wholly unsuitable for them. So,
interesting.
Right. So they eat fermented grains. If they're going to eat grains, they're fermented.
Yeah. And sorghum is much more straightforward to do that with than maize.
But they're mainly pasture fed.
Yeah.
So they get a lot of my biochar. So my throughputs, I've got the, you know, kudos to the great Jeff Lawton. I got the chicken tractor on steroids here, busting 2 rings per month out, about, you know, 2 yards of compost that I use for, you know, little planting soil projects, little raised beds and whatnot, and inoculants. So I do have compost throughputs coming through here. So the chicken rings are quite advantageous in the wintertime because I could keep them warm by placing both of those rings on each side of the chicken tractor. So they're warm in the wintertime, and then their bedding is the fuel source to, you know, decompose all of my garden cuttings because I'm running my chicken tractor alley cropped. So they're doing triple duty for me, giving me eggs, taking care of the nitrogen in the silvopasture context, and getting all the natural farming inputs. They're getting the Oriental herbal nutrients daily in their water. They're getting, you know, the apple cider vinegar. I do apple cider vinegar here. We don't do brown rice vinegar here. But it's just, they're getting the same treatments I'm getting. So I am 155 pounds. I'm 6'2". I used to weigh 185 pounds. Before I started this. But I, you know, the thing about it is that the reason why I'm totally hopeful about this is because the transformation, right? The motif of our sweat. You know, I've observed that there's a show, I'm not a big television watcher, but there's a show that fascinates me, and it's the Celebrity Island, right? With Bear Grylls. And he takes these guys that are like the epitome of, you know, conditioned by the carbon pulse, right? And puts them in an extreme situation where they have to face, you know, starvation and adapt or not survive, right? Or leave.
Mm-hmm.
And to see that, you know, they don't all make it, but to see how they transform through the experience. And every time, what the ones that make it through the experience, you know, physically they're completely changed, right? And they suffered greatly, but what they all did was suffer together.
Yeah.
Right. And it was in that community, right? So getting away from the self, right? And seeing ourselves in community, right? Because the people dream of community just as the land dreams for forest.
Yeah. So getting onto the topic of how we all interface with each other and socially network, maybe, well, let's start by talking about like social organizations in these kind of like permaculture, natural farming, crop breeding communities that you've been part of. And do you have any general observations about what makes certain groups of people work and other ones sometimes, you know, they turn on each other or they fall apart? You know, there's all sorts of dangers and hazards dealing with other people in groups. I mean, we're a kind of dangerous creature when you look at us carefully. So yeah, do you have any experiences and you know, nuggets of wisdom that you can maybe extract from them?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I'm privileged to be in a region that has supported the Ozark Area Community Congress for 45 years. It's the oldest running community congress in the country. And the membership represented represents the Ozark bioregion. And there's a amazing amount of trade network associated with that, knowledge sharing, you know, socialization, and, you know, opportunities for workshops and, you know, just being able to bring your voice forward to the tribe, right? You know, where do we have the opportunity? Because it's not real in the screen world, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
that's artificial. Like when you're face to face with people, it's a different dynamic.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so
do you have any idea why that organization has been so successful for so long? Like what lessons can be learned?
Yeah. Well, I think the lesson is learning from the earth, right? So we're putting aside our anthropomorphism, right? And our narratives of you know, narcissism basically, right? And we can then be of service, right? And transcend Maslow's hierarchy, right? To service of the greater good, service of the whole, right? Of the whole community, and every part of that community is represented. And so we're learning from the earth, right? So respecting that and so disenfranchised, right? And the youth that are disenfranchised with the current situation, right? The socially marginalized, right? The oppressed groups, right? A voice for all those people, right? And just bringing forth the community and having that opportunity to be in community, because we've been atomized, right? We've been atomized in modern society, and just like cancer cells, we're not organized and operating for the good of the organism.
Yeah. Well, on that note, what is the structure of the council? Does it have like a president and elections? Like how is it organized in terms of how do you throw all these people together and make them work?
Yeah, I mean it's all volunteer, right? It's all voluntary. So, you know, if you want to step up, sure, there's needs, and there's different skills to meet those needs. And you know, we never rush. Right. We never rush, but like nature never rushes, but everything always gets accomplished. Right.
It's interesting how difficult it is to capture the magic about what makes certain complex systems functional or dysfunctional. I guess the only thing you can just distill responses that you can make when you see things are not going as well, like heading problems off before they become a systemic issue that affects the whole group. And I don't know, do you have any thoughts on that? Like how, like there's always, there's always going to be some individuals that have difficulty fitting into a group in an organization, and they can potentially just derail things.
Can you
think of any ways that the council has successfully managed those hazards?
Sure. So, you know, when you're in a sweat lodge ritual, every ounce of your body wants to leave because you're dying and you're not sure, but you got to trust, right? You have to trust the community, the other souls that are in there with you. So if you roll out, if you bail on the rest of the people without voicing your concern for them, right? You're just looking to preserve yourself. So you're going to leave without permission or without talking about it. That's an indication that this person is a corrupted narcissist, right? And that's the seed of dissent.
Yeah.
Right. And so that person would be shunned, or that person would be, that gene line would not allowed to be, you know, in times past, right? Would not allowed to be forwarded.
And I think this is a really important point. If you look at the deeper history of successful social groups, they have a really clear idea of who is in the group and who is not, and what is expected of people in the group in order to be part of that community. And I think a lot of modern attempts at building community aren't willing to take on that sometimes unpleasant reality that you need some kind of boundary and you need some kind of expectation. It's a, you know, people want to be seen as being friendly and all inclusive, but in the end, there is no organization if there is no boundary.
Right. I agree. Right. And it's hard to define those, right? Sometimes. Yeah. Well, so
you need some degree of flexibility so that people can join the organization, and when it's absolutely necessary, they can be excluded from the organization as well. I mean, I look at Facebook groups as an example. The ones that are successful have some filtering for people getting into the group, and there's somebody taking responsibility for saying, no, that's not something that we want here. You're going to have to either stop or leave.
Right.
And it's unpleasant work. Like, not many people have the right temperament or the willingness to do that as volunteers, usually. Like, nobody's being paid for Facebook except, you know, the multimillionaires who own the platform. So the emotional labor falls on individuals.
Yes, and we're also challenged by the fact that we're diseased human beings. We're not at ease with our circumstances, and so we're also manipulated by, you know, the social media. And so there's, I don't really know how to describe the recipe that I guess the recipe is everybody has a voice, and so being able to not be marginalized. And so, you know, if we're under the Dunbar number, then, and we are, then it seems to work. And I guess if we get to a point where we're needing to split into smaller groups, then that's what probably needs to happen.
That's one really key ingredient I think people have looked these days is scale. That as groups of people get larger, the amount of rules and regulations and policing needs to increase ever more, particularly when you get beyond, I mean, there's that magic number of 150, but I think in practice, it's often a fair bit lower than that, because individuals are often part of multiple communities where they need to keep track of up to 150 people. And if one group that they're in is 150 people, that's already too many for them to have an idea of everyone who's in that group, because they've got other families and societies and organizations that they're part of that they're juggling at the back of their mind.
Right. So, yeah. So as far as being able to reach out and, you know, organize, you know, young people in this bioregion, our outreach is basically using the newspaper, the Ozark Agrarian News outlet, and word of mouth. I mean, I have not made myself available for interviews. I'm sort of happy to be behind the scenes and willing to put workshops on because I don't care that people know who I am. I mean, I follow after all of the giants, right? Sepp, Holzer, you know, he's my inspiration, right? Well, you go ask Sepp how he does it. He goes, you need to go figure it out, you know, go work with the land. It'll speak to you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And, but as far as like, okay, well, how do you come to this idea that you want to fuse these principles of Korean natural farming with this really complex system of centropic agroforestry, right? Yeah, that's what I'm doing. And I can't explain it to you like other than it's what makes sense because I'm able to plant enough seed in the ground to have selection because there's so much pressure here as far as, you know, the swings, the droughts, like what you're dealing with over there.
Mm-hmm.
I have to have numbers, right? And so I want rootstock that I'm developing from my site. And that the only way I can do that is, you know, working in these networks. So for example, I've got 100 Mount Vernon chestnuts that was given to me by my friend over at the Cosmic Web Alchemy, which I'm grateful for. And I trade my goods back with them. So it's a wonderful barter system. And that's another privilege that we have when we come together as a community and are able to share our resources. And we really depend on each other because you realize that when you get involved with, you know, I hate the word subsistence, right? But, you know, you're subsistence farming, right? You can't do it all, right? Like I did the math. I would have to be working 23 hours a day for my 2.5 kilocalories. But I'm more efficient than 100 watts, right? I could do bursts of like 300 watts.
Yep.
So I can smooth that scale out a little bit.
I always look at my own systems in terms of energy return on energy invested. And I'm not yet at reliably high levels of profit. Like a medieval farmer would leave me in the dust. But I comfort myself by looking at industrial agriculture, which spends like 20 units of oil energy to produce one unit of food. So I'm further ahead than industrial agriculture, you know, despite all of its superficial abundance. So yeah, I think we have to be forgiving with ourselves. We have to understand the magnitude of what we are trying to achieve in just one lifetime.
Yeah, we can only do what we can do, right?
Mm.
And we have a lot of great ideas.
And passing on what you do achieve in your life to other people, I think is the key, because it's very easy. We tend to be very isolated and very self-contained, self-motivated people, or at least I am. And
yeah.
I'm part of this podcast is making an effort to reach out to the world and encourage all of us, you know, lunatic farmer kind of, you know, fringe people to make the effort, which is often uncomfortable. And it sounds like you're in a more accepting community than me, so I'm very jealous in many ways. But making an effort to get those ideas and those seeds into other people's hands to continue the work.
Right, but still, overall, the interest is laughingly minuscule at point in time.
Yeah, yeah. And it probably will be until people really need it. And
until they need it. And then it's going to be, where are the teachers?
Yeah. And where's the locally adapted varieties? Like it takes
Where's
years
the genetics?
It takes years to go through the trials and the selection and developing the methods that go along with it. So yeah, we're kind of the scouts of this process. And it may be another generation before people are in a position where they're really motivated to get involved on any large scale.
And we're not gonna beat the superorganism, right?
No, we just have to outlast it.
Right. So for me, I can just do it cheaper without any harmful side effects, right?
Mm.
So there's zero externalized costs. Right? There's just nothing but like benefit.
Mm.
Right? And so they're irrelevant, right? So I'm empowered. I have agency, more agency, because now I don't have to travel to go find my inputs or buy my inputs. Mm-hmm. So now I'm not only saving that, but I'm also saving the, you know, CO2 being emitted from these fertilizer, the Haber-Bosch process making fertilizer.
A question I forgot to ask before, do you have a dream crop that if you had like unlimited time and resources that you would wish existed in the world? And there might be an angle that's unusual for syntropic or Korean natural farming. There could be some support species rather than just another crop that would be a really useful ingredient in those kind of systems. Or it might even be an animal. Nobody's thought to say, I want an animal that does this.
What about, you know, I think that what's going on right now is we already have that, the magic wand, the chimeras through, you know, gene editing. It's not novel. So I think flipping that on its head, what I want is original ZMAs back, so uncontaminated. That's what I want. I want uncontaminated non-GMO crop. I want to undo the magic wand.
Interesting. It's like the Midas touch. Like sometimes you wish for something and you get it and you realize you're actually better off beforehand.
Right? Exactly. Now Monsanto has your genetics. So when the world turns to, you know, agronomists, when there's multinational companies that have monopolies on the genetics because they've gone into these, you know, countries like mafias and stolen the genetics by copyright and then make obscene profits charging farmers exorbitant prices for seed, right? Then, you know, it's a self-terminating system. Right. So we have to be the ones because we're not going to, I don't see any traction happening in, you know, the political realm. Nothing's going to happen there.
No.
Like we have to make it happen. Right.
Yeah.
So we have to inspire young people. Like I was alluding to my nieces and nephews who really want a meaningful work and want to understand what it means to live a meaningful life. And I think that connection is made when the knowledge gap is jumped because we have the younger generation working with the older generation. And so you're able to share that in that cultural context, which we just don't have. And we are doing that here. So I'm 53 turns around the rock here. And if I'm not able to complete my knowledge by teaching others, then I don't truly understand this material.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any advice on strategies for getting young people involved in these kind of activities? Like what's worked for you for getting them interested and excited?
Yeah. Yeah, so I got internet yesterday and the installer, all installers came over. One of the installers was from Brazil. So I was talking to him in Spanish. And the other, his little sidekick person was a native Missourian. And so I asked her if she spoke another language. And she says, no, I'm American. I said, well, I'm American too, but isn't it important to be bilingual? You're working with a Brazilian guy, right? So she kind of thought about that. And I said, well, how much are they paying you here? And she said, well, I'm an intern. They're not paying me anything. I said, well, you know, if you want a job security, you know, out here, you see these woods out here, they're sick. All these trees, they're dying because there's no light getting in the understory. There hasn't been burns done here for generations. So there's a lot of work to be done doing wildlife restoration and ecological restoration. You can work for the rest of your life doing meaningful work. What I'm doing right here, I'm dirty and dusty because I've been out doing earthworks, but I sure like when I get to put seed in the ground, it's really, really enjoyable. And man, she had this look in her eye. She understood. She's a country girl. And there's this, I sense I made an impact on her, right? I think it's just inspiring them and just coming into contact with them in a real way, right? Not not convincing anybody over social media or anything like that, but just like living true to yourself. And people see your light, they see your energy and vitality. And, you know, what are you plugged into? You know what I mean? I want some of that.
It's interesting because the next book I think I'm going to try and write will be crop breeding for children, particularly the homeschooled children movement. There's so many kids out there in that critical window where they're like forming core experiences, and they tend to be more curious and exploratory, and they take risks. And I think that's the demographic where I can create the most crop breeders that will have the biggest impact into the future. So give me a few years. I want to actually roll out like pilot programs and make it work, not just fill a book with my ideas and hope that they function. So yeah, keep an eye for that in the future.
For sure, right? I mean, there's what I find interesting is how those of us land stewards, we're calling ourselves practitioners, right? Who else calls themselves practitioners? Meditators, right? So I do see that, you know, this is a dharma. This work is a dharma in that respect. And so, yeah, us practitioners, we're working with our hands. And my niece learned how to make seed bombs, right? Love bombs of seeds. And she can't wait to come back out here and see what grew.
Yeah.
From the seed bombs that she put out.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's it, man. That's how we do it. Relationships.
Yeah. 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 Brilliant. So let's wrap off. This has been an amazing conversation. So a couple of final questions. What is your vision for the future of food in your community?
Oh, yeah. So I see agroforestry taking a bigger role here, especially in the southern counties of the state. You know, we've got the opportunity to produce abundantly here in this bioregion. We get lots of rainfall. And there's a huge need to restore these woodlands and forests. And so we could do both of these things and, you know, have a thriving trade network within our bioregion and even be able to work outside of our bioregion.
Who do you think I should interview next? Do you have any like dream guests that you want to see me chase down and take an hour of their time?
The Mark Shepherd.
Oh, yeah, big Sheva. Influence, big influence. I already interviewed him for the Going to Seed podcast. Okay. So that episode is out there. And in the future, give me a couple of years and I'll track him down again.
Yeah, you might be able to get a hold of Young Sang. I might be able to see if we could get somebody from Korean Natural Farming official.
That would be amazing. You know? That would be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, we have to have interpreters.
Well, I've previously done written interviews that I've then turned into the audio version, so I can translate what they write and then get someone else to stand in their part to fill in the answers to the questions. It's a little bit less back and forth, but it gets the ideas across and it gives a voice to anyone on the planet, really.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Now, you're not a hugely public personality, but is there anywhere that people can learn more about your work or get in touch? There was that essay that you sent me. Would I be able to link to that in the show notes?
Yeah, I think I put that on a Google Doc. So I'll see if you can get that link.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a really inspirational path forward. And it just sort of gives an overview. You know, I think that from the 30,000 foot view, it's enough to attend the workshop.
Yeah. Yeah. you did mention as well that you've read my short book, Taming the Apocalypse.
Right.
Did you have any thoughts on that?
I mean, dude, 30,000 years. I mean, because here's what I started thinking about when I was a kid. I read, I'm not sure if it was Heinlein's book, but where an algae got out of control and they were bioengineering this algae and it ended up deoxygenating the planet. And this one guy was able to like survive on this island all by himself. And he had a Cadillac and he disassembled the Cadillac and he made a little generator out of the alternator. Oh, man, it was like that. I'm reading it in the future going, of course, right? If we're going to do this thing into the future, if we're going to pay or be around to survive at this experiment, it's good. Biology is going to be the way forward, right? Mm. I mean, how many geological ages of intelligence is wrapped around, you know, what these things are that we call matter, right? And I don't know, have you ever listened to Bill Minch, the guy that made RSC protocol, the computer chips? He's like a legend in computer programming.
No, I don't, but tell me more.
So anyways, he's kind of gone outside of his field, and he's come up with this theory of everything. And he's talking about how you have this intelligence, this natural intelligence that exists, and it's impersonal, right? And then it wraps around it embeds itself, right? And is embedded intelligence, right? And that's the field, right? That's the self-organizing field that where the traits come from, right? That's where traits come from, right?
Yeah.
And then we're able to take that embedded intelligence and then make synthetic intelligence out of that, right? So basically, I don't think he knew, maybe he did, but he basically modeling like the Platonic, you know, Tōhen, Nous, and Psyche, right? So it's intelligence being fundamental.
Yeah.
Right? And it's just very simple. Right. And so I wouldn't say that in the Platonic sense, it's a embeddedness. It's more of an emanation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's emanating from one to the next. Right. Where we get this concept of the nous, where all things actually exist. Right. And it's fascinating because it explains why when I plant all of these different seeds, there's so many trait drivers. I mean, these intelligences are able to adapt, right? And it's seemingly on the fly, right? I mean, we're getting hazelnuts in an annual turnover. Wow.
That's what I really love thinking about the future for all of the struggles that are likely to be ahead of us with the end of industrialization. We're not just going to go back to living in medieval villages. We've stirred up all of these possibilities and that are going to lead in unexpected directions. And everyday people can be part of that process because biology is everywhere around us. You can lay your hands on it without having to walk more than 5 steps out of your door.
Exactly. Yeah. So I really appreciate your take on, you know, the polycrisis. And that not needing to set the table for this conversation, right? Like we already understand like the predicament that we're in, right? So mm-hmm. we're past the doom stage. We're in the doomor stage, right? Where everything we're about is driven by this passion, right?
Yeah.
And it's like effortless, right? And that is way. Right. In the Eastern philosophy, the natural farming, you know, comes out of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Is that simplicity and trusting nature, right? And not trying to control outcomes.
Yeah.
It's very Taoist.
Yeah.
So I love it, right? And so we're gonna flow with the power of water in that humble sense and make massive changes without effort.
So is that your final message for people thinking about getting into this world?
Yes. Yeah,
I was just about to ask that question, but that's embodying the principle. It's like you've already answered it.
Right. I mean, what it is like having fun. It's like the conversation that we're having is just so much fun. Mm-hmm. And everybody that is involved in the community Congress, it's just we get together and it's just there's just so much of a quorum effect and a buzz of electricity. And that's the same thing I experience when I have biodiversity here. I'm looking for that quorum effect. Because we're the land, right? We already know what we need to do.
Yeah.
It's embedded intelligence.
And it's collective intelligence too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, on that hopeful and inspiring note, Nathaniel, thank you very much for taking the time to chat to me and everyone here today. The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.